Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Michael Tilson Thomas is music director of the San Francisco Symphony and the founder and artistic director of the New World Symphony in Miami. He's also the principal guest conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra. Over the course of his now almost 40-year career, Tilson Thomas has conducted many of the world's greatest orchestras. He was recently in town to lead the Philadelphia Orchestra, and when we met backstage at the Kimmel Center, I first asked him how he saw his role when guest conducting an orchestra.
The way I think of myself as a conductor is a little bit in the role of director slash coach, something like this. And what a director does, or a director works with different casts of people who are great. They are great people. They have amazing abilities. And the director tries to give them some possibilities of using their essentially great qualities to still perhaps greater advantage, more effective advantage. Because when people are in the midst of the ensemble situation, they, in their absorption of doing all they have to do, perhaps don't see that they really should be taking a little bit more time over here, or perhaps they should be giving one of their colleagues a little bit more room there, and, you know, that their roles of variously supporting one another or challenging one another or whatever it may be could be perhaps pointed up a bit more, which would give a more exciting shape to the entire proceedings and at the same time would be most essentially about the incredible communicative talent of those people who are actually giving the performance.
And you mentioned the word communicate. How do you communicate, or how do you learn how to communicate with a group of 100-plus musicians in the short space of time that you're going to spend with them?
Well, at this point in my life, I just kind of go for it. I just do it. You know, I just start talking about certain specific situations which relate to timing and rhythm and breathing, and certain things relate to tone quality. And a thing that I like to do very much is that the orchestra contains people who have great careers as soloists and chamber musicians, and sometimes by referring them to music which they know from that other world, it can cause them to think about it differently and perhaps bring more personal qualities that they might be associating with that part of their lives more into what can happen in the orchestra.
And you talk about it being different casts, the Philadelphia Orchestra being your Philadelphia cast. Mm-hmm. You're in London, you're the principal guest conductor there. Does your approach vary with the cast that's put in front of you?
Yes.
How so?
Because I have certain ideals of what the piece in its totality should be about. And with different ensembles, they have natural instincts which make different parts of that design instantly clear, so that I might hear in one orchestra that they have an astounding rhythmic organization, and another one that have amazing tonal lushness, and another one that has great variety of idiosyncratic wind players or whatever it might be, and also that the hall allows various things. So I'm saying, okay, well, all these things are already in focus. Maybe we can do more with some of these other qualities over here, or perhaps if I, you know, suddenly realize that there's an astoundingly powerful and organized double bass section, say, well, aha, we can really make the bass line still a more dramatic part of the proceedings because the talents and strengths of the section suggest that that might be possible.
And then in working with your other two, your day jobs, so to speak, in San Francisco and in Miami, clearly very different approaches there. In San Francisco, a group of very well-established musicians, in the New World Symphony, younger players. Mm-hmm. Clearly, in San Francisco, you have years of working with them and you have, you know, formed them in your own likeness, so to speak. With the New World, it's an ever-changing cast. It's younger musicians. How is the approach in those two different situations?
Well, San Francisco is, of course, very accustomed to the particular things that I tend to ask for, which are usually more extreme than what many of my colleagues may ask for. A lot of conductors do enjoy kind of organizing things and establishing certain limits on things. It's generally my nature to do the opposite. I'm trying to encourage people to kind of color outside the lines and figure out ways in which they could be more soloistic. They could take more chances. You know, an orchestra, as I've said many times, is a large ensemble of people, and generally in a large number of people, we all try and find some middle ground. We're told that in society and in life, that's good. We find some middle ground on which we can agree, and that's kind of consensus. Well, that, they say, works well in society. Doesn't actually work so well in an orchestra, because then everything is kind of mezzo piano, mezzo forte, not too short, not too long. And the whole idea of what you need to do is to encourage people to go to various kinds of extremes at particular moments. And in the case of something like a Mahler symphony, it means that somebody might have to be playing the most legato tender music while somebody else is just barking or baying at the moon in a quite outrageous fashion. And those elements must coexist with one another, because the music is representing different streams of thought or different ideas in the world, as Mahler claimed it did.
And you must be communicating both those ideas simultaneously.
Yes, and also I'm clear at establishing for the orchestra that there are different levels of expression simultaneously occurring, and which is the level in which they at this moment find themselves, and also that there are particular moments in which the whole drama of the piece hinges on what one second clarinetist may do, and that he understands that that is his big moment, and that everyone's relying upon him to do something completely out of the box.
Michael Tilson Thomas. He was recently in Philadelphia to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra in Aaron Copland's Symphony for Organ and Orchestra with soloist Paul Jacobs and Mahler's Symphony No. 5.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
This weekend, the Philadelphia Theatre Company begins performances of At Home at the Zoo, an expanded version of Edward Albee's famous 1958 one-act play, The Zoo Story. It's the first time the full play has been performed in Philadelphia, but as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the work by the three-time Pulitzer Prize winner continues to shed insights into the complexity of human relationships.
Albee's original version, The Zoo Story, centers on Peter and Jerry, two strangers who meet on a bench in Central Park.
I've been to the zoo. I said I've been to the zoo. Mister, I've been to the zoo.
Hmm? What? I'm sorry, were you talking to me?
I went to the zoo, and then I walked until I came here. Have I been walking north?
Jerry, played by Andrew Polk, is a loner with a penchant for storytelling. Peter, played by Scott Cunningham, is a publisher of textbooks who lives on New York's East Side. For decades, the unfolding of their conversation and its dramatic conclusion have made The Zoo Story a play that theaters and universities return to again and again. 81-year-old Edward Albee, who also wrote Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and A Delicate Balance, says the one-act Zoo Story was his first serious attempt at theater.
I'd failed at all of the branches of writing by my late 20s. I'd started out as a poet, then turned into a novelist and a short story writer, and I was pretty bad at all those things, but I was determined that I was a writer. There wasn't much left to do, so I wrote a play, and it was called The Zoo Story. It was the first time I'd written anything that I knew was any good. I could tell. I said, you know, this isn't bad.
After the play premiered in West Berlin, double-billed with Samuel Beckett's Crap's Last Tape, it opened in Manhattan in 1960. Mary Robinson, director of the Philadelphia Theater Company's At Home at the Zoo, says Albee's one act was soon recognized as a groundbreaking play.
It was a gritty subject, Zoo Story, and that was not, you know, your typical commercial theater fare. And then right after Zoo Story, the off-Broadway movement began to just really burgeon with Lamford Wilson, John Guare, Sam Shepard. All of those playwrights, I think, would say they really owe a debt to Edward Albee, because it was his, you know, Zoo Story and of course, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in 1962, that really sort of set the scene for a lot of the work that came in the 60s.
About 5 years ago, Albee added to the zoo narrative, calling it home life. According to Albee, this backstory is the first act of the Zoo Story, not to be mistaken for a prequel.
I hate the term prequel. It is no longer a one-act play. It is now a two-act play.
Albee now insists that professional theaters perform only the two-act version, called At Home at the Zoo. The story starts in Peter's house the morning before the publishing executive encounters Jerry in the park. Foreshadowing the beginning of the second act, Peter and his wife Anne, played by Susan McKee, strike up a conversation as Peter reads a book in the living room and Anne cooks in the kitchen.
We should talk.
What? We should what? We should what?
What? We should what?
We should what?
Oh, we should talk.
I was reading. I'm sorry.
It happens so often.
As Susan McKee first read through At Home at the Zoo in preparation for her role as Anne, she asked herself a question a lot of people might wonder.
I don't know. If you've got Zoo Story, you don't want to mess with a good thing. And why would he do that? What is that about?
Because it kept nagging me that the character of Peter in the Zoo Story really wasn't quite as developed as the character Jerry. And I thought we needed to know more about him. Now, I wasn't going to rewrite the Zoo Story because I don't rewrite my plays. Because I'm not the same person 40 years after I write something. I don't want to mess with what I've written. So the only answer was to write a first act, which is what I did, and luckily it made it a much better play.
In the view of director Mary Robinson, the two acts make for a more complex story.
It fleshes out the questions about relationships that Zoo Story asks, in that, you know, they're opposite ends of the spectrum. Zoo Story is about two people who just meet for the first time, and Home Life is about two people who've lived together for many years and had children together. And yet it really is about how we connect, how we communicate, what we mean to each other.
Robinson says, though the acts were written about 45 years apart, the two scenes fit together well as a full-length play. But Robinson also believes each act reflects the different seasons of life in which Alvie wrote the pieces. The Zoo Story has a youthful, edgy quality to it, while Home Life offers a seasoned and mature perspective of long-term relationships. To bridge these similar yet contrasting acts, Robinson says it's been beneficial to have input from Edward Albee. The playwright, who was based in New York, approved the casting and set design for the Philadelphia production and visited the cast and director about once a week as they rehearsed. Albee says while he doesn't want to impose, he's eager to be helpful.
Since it's a production that's close to New York and in a good city and a lot of interesting people will see it, I wanted to involve myself in rehearsals.
And the magnitude of working with such a revered writer doesn't escape Susan McKee.
It's very nervous when he's 4 feet away and writing notes when you're doing his play. But at the same time, you have to remember how lucky we are to be able to have this experience.
For over 50 years now, theater audiences have been able to experience the compelling and at times disturbing writing of Albee plays. From Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf to Seascape to The Goat or Who is Sylvia? The two-act Zoo Story, and perhaps this production in particular, overseen by its creator, gives a rare glimpse into the span of this creative mind, one of the greatest living playwrights.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Philadelphia Theater Company's At Home at the Zoo is at the Suzanne Roberts Theater through April 19th. This year, Barack Obama made history by becoming the first African-American president of the United States. Yet for centuries, despite years of enslavement and decades of incomplete protection under law, African Americans have been helping shape America. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to America I Am, the African American imprint, an exhibition now at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia.
In 1903, the African American scholar and political activist W.E.B. Du Bois posed a question about American identity, echoed today, over 100 years later, by the exhibition's presenter, the broadcaster Tavis Smiley.
Would America have been America without her Negro people?
This thought is the premise for America I Am, conceived by Smiley after a visit to Jamestown, Virginia, where a Dutch ship brought the first African-American slaves in the early 1600s. Smiley says Du Bois' question provides a good starting point for telling African-American history in a new way.
Trying to answer that question in terms of the imprint that African Americans have had on this place called America, culturally, economically, spiritually, politically.
A team of 44 scholars on a range of subjects came on board as advisors. John Fleming, Director Emeritus of Museums at the Cincinnati Museum Center, currently the president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, signed on as executive producer and began a widespread search for artifacts.
For example, I came to Philadelphia looking to get a gown of Marian Anderson. They didn't have any. But someone told me, why don't you go down to Richmond? There's a little museum. They had 6 gowns down there.
And so one discovery led to another.
When I was talking with the National Park Service, they said, well, you should include James Dexter. He had a house under the parking lot here at the National Constitution Center. He had a connection with St. Thomas Church. That led me up to St. Thomas Church, and I found out that they had the original altar that Absalom Jones put in the church in 1792. And then on top of that, they had records of the Free African Society, and no one ever thought that any of those records existed.
The resulting history, called America I Am, the African American imprint, dovetails with the overarching theme of the National Constitution Center itself, the story of the three words that begin the U.S. Constitution, we the people.
That struggle over who's we has been something that has been with us from the beginning.
Joe Torsella was longtime National Constitution Center president before stepping down earlier this year to run for the U.S. Senate.
And it's the story of how we have defined that and how Americans have struggled to be included in that and how that definition has grown broader and stronger and better over time. This exhibit is really in the sweet spot for us.
America I Am presents the African-American story in a journey through 12 connecting galleries. Just beyond the entrance, a hallway where images of African-Americans appear to fall into shadow as a visitor walks past, leads back in time to a room representing Africa. John Fleming says it was important to start in Africa, for while enslaved people couldn't bring objects with them, they brought their knowledge and skills.
African culture changed as it encountered European culture. European culture changed as it encountered African culture. And what emerged was a new American culture, and it began during the colonial period and blossomed in the 21st century.
Over 300 artifacts are interspersed with artwork, murals, film footage, and text panels that pinpoint historical milestones in the journey to today's America. Each gallery creates a different environment with dramatic lighting, ambient sounds, and in some cases, theatrical set design. Mark Locke is Senior Vice President of Arts and Exhibitions International, the company that created the show.
A theatrical presentation is important to put people there. The artifacts, the stories will always be the focus, but anytime you can put them in context, put you there a little bit, then I think it's even more meaningful.
After leaving Africa, visitors walk past the actual doors of no return from the Cape Coast Castle in Ghana into a small, dark space, conjuring up the idea of a dungeon holding area. Several rooms beyond, a handwritten letter guaranteeing free passage to Frederick Douglass, and a cotton gin set against a stone wall with crickets in the background help tell about the time of the Underground Railroad. Further along, the actual stool and key sit in front of recreated jail doors depicting the cell from which Martin Luther King wrote his letter from a Birmingham jail.
Let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities.
Everyday accessories of ordinary people are intermingled with belongings of the famous. Phyllis Wheatley's writing desk, the typewriter that Alex Haley used to type Roots, Muhammad Ali's robe, Jackie Robinson's jersey, and the rock star Prince's purple guitar. Bits of every part of life, music and the arts, entertainment and sports, politics, the military, and the church, come together to tell the history of African Americans. It is a story of America. Former Constitution Center President Joe Torsella says this exhibition speaks to the essence of American civic identity.
In this long struggle for full liberty and inclusion, the African-American journey has become the American journey, and in the struggle to be part of full citizenship, it's helped create a better kind of citizenship for everyone.
Near the end of the show, autographed in an open notebook, sits Barack Obama's now famous speech on race, delivered at the National Constitution Center last March.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, 221 years ago.
One advisor to America I Am is Princeton professor Cornell West, who cautions that however celebratory the exhibition's closing gallery, the struggle is not over, and we must continue to keep track of all our people, especially the poor.
No matter what color the president, because what this is about justice, it's about truth, and that cuts much deeper than any pigmentation or skin color.
And this exhibition gives the sense that the story has a beginning and a middle, but it's not an ending story.
Yeah, that's right. It's incomplete. Like any great democratic experiment, it's unfinished and incomplete. It's open-ended. It depends on what we do right now. And that's our challenge.
Would America have been America without her African-American people? American music without the soul of jazz, the harmony of Motown, or the beat of rock and roll. Without Duke Ellington, Marian Anderson, or Jimi Hendrix. American sports without Jackie Robinson or Michael Jordan. Poetry and literature without Maya Angelou, Langston Hughes, and Ralph Ellison. Would America be the land of opportunity without the quiet courage of Rosa Parks or the vision of Martin Luther King? Clearly not. They are of us, and we all are of them. We, the people.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. America I Am, the African American imprint, is at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia through May 3rd. Anyone who has ever attended a local sports event knows that Philadelphians love their beer. But what's less well understood is the role that Philadelphia brewers played in the social and architectural development of the city during the 19th century. Now, WRTI's Tom Keels explores Philadelphia breweries, past and present.
The biggest mausoleums in West Laurel Hill Cemetery in Lower Merion belong to 19th century Philadelphia brewers. Stand in front of the old office, and the largest tombs in sight are two marble temples bearing the names Bergdahl and Poff. Behind the office looms the Betz Mausoleum, a German Baroque fantasy. Although the names Bergdahl, Betz, and Poff are little known today, these brewers were major commercial and community leaders in Victorian Philadelphia, according to Williams College history professor Michael J. Lewis.
Around these breweries, almost all of which were run by Germans, grew up large communities of workers' housing, social institutions, banks, which made these neighborhoods coherent groupings of German culture.
Philadelphia was home to breweries from its birth. When William Penn landed in 1682, beer was already being brewed on Dock Creek. But, says Rich Wagner, president of the Pennsylvania Brewery Historians, Philadelphia did not become a national brewing center until 1840.
John Wagner came from Bavaria, smuggled yeast from his brewery there, somehow got to Philadelphia. His brother-in-law helped him set up a home brewery.
Philadelphia's growing German population and the pure water from its artesian wells made the city a beer lover's paradise. In 1880, over a dozen breweries operated in Brewery Town alone, the district bounded by 30th Street, Oxford Street, 33rd Street, and Girard Avenue. By 1900, beer production had spread throughout the city. Rich Wagner recalls,
"When I was growing up and I would ask the old people, tell me about Brewery Town, and the common response was Philadelphia was one big brewery town. In 1888, there were probably, 96 breweries or 95 breweries in the city."
Many of these breweries operated in sprawling complexes of handsome brick buildings with stone and terracotta trim. Michael Lewis reveals that this uniform look was no coincidence.
Virtually every brewery in Philadelphia was built by one man, and that was Otto Charles Wolfe. And the characteristic look of the Philadelphia brewery, which is brick, relieved with granite and terracotta trim, it tends to be a proud and haughty tower with a bold outline. This is the creation of Otto Wolfe.
Wolfe designed most of Philadelphia's major breweries, including Bergner and Engel, Poff, and Schmidt. But his masterpiece was the Bergdahl Brewing Company, built in the 1880s at 28th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. Michael Lewis thinks that Wolfe's design was influenced by Frank Furness, the leading architect of the period.
To my eye, it's the best example of Otto Wolfe trying to do what Furness did with his banks, to create some lumbering, top-heavy, cheeky, arrogant proclamation of identity. The way the Central Bay corbels out reprises what Furness did at the Provident Life and Trust Bank. This is by far the most adventuresome brewery that Wolfe ever designed.
Today, these elegant structures have been transformed into condos. Another Otto Wolfe creation, the former Class and Nakod Brewery at 10th Street and Montgomery Avenue, now serves as a Temple University dormitory and office center. Rich Wagner explains that the survival of the entire Class and Nakod complex is a unique story.
What's interesting about this is it's a complete brewery complex. You had the large building over here, which would have housed the brew house, and then the vast fermenting and aging cellars. And then the next to the stable and garage would have been the bottling shop. And then behind this is where you see the smokestack would have been where you had the boiler house.
For Wagner, The beauty and solidity of brewery buildings is a testament to their owners' pride and faith in their own future.
These were their industrial castles, and they intended them to be here forever.
But this seemingly permanent world evaporated between 1910 and 1920, when it was hit by the double whammy of anti-German sentiment during World War I and the economic devastation of Prohibition, says Michael Lewis.
So in the scheme of Philadelphia history, it's a very short reign of power these brewers enjoy.
After Prohibition began in 1920, Brewery Town became a ghost town. While a few brewers reopened after Prohibition was repealed in 1933, Philadelphia was no longer a great beer town. Some abandoned factories still dominate their neighborhoods, like the Ortley Brewery at American and Poplar Streets, or the Poff Plant at Jefferson and 31st Streets. Others have been demolished, like the Giant Schmitz Complex at 2nd and Girard, now an empty field. Berwich Wagner believes that Philadelphia is entering a beer renaissance.
We have Yards just opened a new brewery, Philadelphia Brewing Company. We have Notting Head Brewery and Restaurant. We have Manayunk Brewery and Restaurant. And we have Triumph Brewery. Oh, I didn't mention Dock Street. There's a new brewery out in West Philly.
At the intersection of Frankfort Avenue and York Street in Kensington stands the Weisbrod and Hess Brewery, designed by A.C. Wagner in the 1880s. Today, this Victorian complex is alive with the sound of delivery trucks and the smell of fresh hops. Since 2001, the brewery has housed the Philadelphia Brewing Company. Nancy Barton, co-owner of the company, found that recycling the 19th-century structures for a 21st-century business was easier than expected.
We bought this building in May of 2001, and it needed a lot of cosmetic work. But because the building was built as a brewery, structurally it was perfect. It's brick and concrete, and you know it was built strong and built to last.
She says she's felt great satisfaction in restoring the old brewery to its original purpose.
We bought the building, and all the windows were concreted up and boarded up, and it looked abandoned. So it is very rewarding and satisfying to look back and see what we've done to it and kind of regenerated it and put new life into it.
While Philadelphia may have far fewer breweries today than it had at its peak, it is still possible to appreciate the architectural beauty of its survivors. And it's still possible to relax with a tall, cool pint of a local brew, whether it's Philadelphia Pale Ale, Row House Red, or even Walt Witt.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.